Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. We're recording on a Monday, but we're going to be broadcasting on a Tuesday. So if you're listening to it now, you're probably not listening to it live. But if you happen to have read our blog post, you can call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. This is the last Cooking Issues before the big museum fundraiser event that's going on at Del Posto next weekend on Sunday. You can still go and buy your tickets at MOFAD, M-O-F-A-D, that's Museum of Food and Drink, MOFAD.eventbrite, B-R-I-T-E, .com. That's MOFAD.eventbrite.com. Anyway, we are privileged today to have a special call-in guest. Harold McGee is going to be the ultimate master blaster of the science of deliciousness. He's going to be joining us via phone. Unfortunately, we're working very hard on the museum event, and so Nastasha cannot be with us today in the studio because, in fact, she is delivering produce to WD-50 because Wiley Dufresne is going to be working on the dish today for, doing some preparatory work today for his dish. So no Nastasha, but we do have Harold. Harold, are you there?
I am, Dave. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay.
How's the West Coast treating you?
It's okay. This last week has been really rainy and cold. Today it was sunny to begin with, but the sun has disappeared, so it looks like it may be another grim week.
I'd love it then. You know, I hate the sunshine.
Right. Yeah. Well, but, 50 degrees, you want a few rays.
Yeah, all right. Yes, if it's going to be 50 out, might as well be a little bit sunny. Okay, so you want to start hitting these questions? We have a bunch of email questions in.
Sure.
Before we start, someone wrote in one of the questions. They want to know the secret of Thai iced tea. The mysterious spices in Thai iced tea. And I have to say, I don't know, because I'm not I don't drink it. Do you drink it?
I'm afraid I haven't for a long time. I did a couple times years ago, and I just can't pull back the flavors.
Yeah, and so, I mean, I think that, this is the kind of question Aaron wrote in with it. I think this is the kind of question... I would hate to give just a researched answer off of the web of what belongs in it because I don't have the actual taste memory in my head to know whether it's right or not. It's not something I've worked on because it's not something that – it's just not something that I've, focused on ever. But, I'm sure that we can find the answer. I mean, if you if you see Pim when you're out there or something like that, we can probably get the answer of what the stuff is. But I would hate to guess on something like that.
Yeah, no, same here.
All right, Aaron, so I apologize, but I will not be able to answer that question this week because I just don't want to give an answer that's BS. I'd rather not give a BS. I'd rather give no answer than a BS answer, right?
Yeah, and also, I mean, for Aaron to do his own research, Shea Pym would be a good place to start. David Thompson's book on Thai cooking seems to be the standard. So there are a couple of authorities you can start with and then kind of move on from there.
Yeah, I'm sure Thompson has a recipe for it in the book. I have it at home. I just haven't been home to look at it to get the recipe out of it. But his book is, as far as I can tell, quite well respected. I know that he's done all of his research on the old manuscripts. So he has a thorough knowledge of current Thai cooking and historical Thai cooking. So,
and in fact, I think he has a new book this last year on street cooking, street Thai, which might be an even better place to look.
Yeah. And that's where we'd probably go anyway if we were just going to give you. It wouldn't be our answer. It would be his answer anyway. So
Yeah, exactly.
or check out Pim's site. Now, I'm going to knock out one question right away. And, Harold, you can chime in because you've had some of this stuff. But Rick writes in and says that his roommate, Zach's advisor, just purchased a new rotary evaporator for the lab and has agreed to let them use it for a few days for food purposes, and they want to take maximum advantage of everything that they can do in it. And, they want to build their own, but they're not ready for it quite yet, and so they want to know what we should do. Like, he just wants to distill basically as much as possible. He wants to get the flavors of falernum into it, maybe. He wants to do... Martell Cordon Bleu is right for something. I've actually wrote of that, and Harold, you've had it. We did an event with Mandy Aftel where we wrote of Martell with frankincense. I don't know whether you like frankincense, but Martell does wrote of that quite well. He wants to do something with maybe absinthe, any of these things, oak, dirt, grass, cigars, peppers, like guajillo, ancho, and stuff like that. What are the rotovap stuff do you like, Harold?
Pretty much everything you've done.
Thanks.
I love what you do with habaneros, for example. That's an amazing experience to be able to separate the heat from the aroma.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I've done dried and have you ever had any of the dried pepper? I prefer the fresh pepper ones because I like the floral note that they have more.
Yeah, yeah. And then, I mean, the dishes that I've had that have really stuck in my head, in fact, the very first one is probably still the one I remember best, is the Roca family did an oyster in a jelly that was flavored with earth. One of the ideas on the list here was, along with oak and grass and cigars, was dirt. And dirt works, although you and I had it, I think, when the Rocas were visiting the FCI, and it wasn't the same.
Well, they didn't give it to me. He said he was going to give it to me, and he didn't, probably because it wasn't the same, maybe.
Yeah. So, in fact, I had it, and it wasn't as good. And I think with something, a flavoring that you rotovap that isn't a standard food ingredient, it's more of an environmental aroma, I think you have to just nail the concentration just right. Otherwise, it tastes like dirt instead of like the forest.
Well, and also, they were using a water-based distillate, and the water-based distillates tend not to be fixed very well. So if they're opening and closing the bottle and it has to be transported, I mean, I don't know what kind of freshness problem they have with that just in terms of loss of the volatiles. But, I mean, it's a huge problem with non-alcoholic rotovapped products is that they just tend to – the aroma is so fugitive, they tend to just go, you know? Could that have been it? Was it overly dirty or was it just not as – just unbalanced? What was it, the one?
Well, it's a good question. I was guessing that it was the concentration because it did seem to be just stronger, but it could have been stronger because, you know, the wrong things were popping out, and so it could have been that it was just a, you know, he had to prepare the distillate and then bring it with him, and who knows how many days old it was, and that may have been the problem.
Right. Well, okay, if you have a rotovap for just like a couple of days, I would recommend trying something that you could do no other way, and that would be some sort of fresh herb, right? Some sort of fresh herb that you distill, and I would drink that right away. Make it very, very fresh, very, you know, summery, spring-like. That's like, you know, the one that we do with the Thai basil and cilantro and the cucumber and the orange, right? Something like that with those flavors, because you can't recreate that with a normal distillation because the temperature is too high and it's going to alter the flavor of the herb. So I would definitely do that. I would then do something like a pepper. I would choose a fresh one that's floral, kind of red, so you can get the floral notes, so you can see what it's like that the spice doesn't go through. I would then do horseradish because horseradish makes an intensely pungent because the pungent principle of horseradish does distill, and that's going to last you a long time. So you'll have that for a good long time. Then just start doing wacky things like de-oak some liquors, try some of the culinary preps like dirt or earth. Just remember, you're going to have to some of the things that are more aromatic, like horseradish or habaneros or whatever you do, you're going to have to totally break down and clean all the grease out of the rotovap joints before you run the next batch because you'll get contaminated. There's also, if you've never run one, unless your roommate knows how to run it really well or the professor knows how to run it really well, there is a learning curve associated with it. Don't set it to the automatic distillation. Sit there and actually constantly force the distillation so that you're getting the fastest rate possible. Set your chiller as low as it can possibly go. For alcohol, you're going to want to set it around minus 20 Celsius. We now use a cold finger distillation, distill with liquid nitrogen, and we can do water-based distillations that way. But have some fun with it. Tell us how it worked out. Right? That's good advice, right, Harold?
Yeah. It's always fun.
Good stuff. I've never done a cigar. I don't know. I've done smoky stuff. I've never done a cigar. Anyway, An unsmoked cigar, you think he means, or like the ashes of cigar?
No, it must be unsmoked. I mean, the fermented leaves, that would be really interesting.
Right. Right, but it's not characteristically what you think of as cigar, the smoke. It's a completely different thing.
Well, yeah, it's the cigar box smell rather than the smoke room, which I think is a good thing.
Right, yeah. All right, here's a question for you, Harold. Does using reduced fat milk lead to a higher whey production in when you're making yogurt, like if you were to break it?
Well, it shouldn't, because if you're using reduced fat milk, usually reduced fat milk is supplemented with whey solids, which include lactoglobulin, which is a whey protein, not the casein proteins that curdle, but whey protein that's soluble. But when you heat the milk, which you should do at 180 for 30 minutes before you make the yogurt, that protein denatures and helps give the yogurt body and water-retaining ability. And so a reduced-fat milk is going to have more of that protein, and it should, in fact, release less whey rather than more.
Hmm. And the heating then is necessary to alter the whey proteins. That is a necessary step, because that was one of the questions before.
Yeah, in fact, if you just make the yogurt without the preheating step, you'll of course still get curdled milk, but it's not going to have the kind of thick, pleasing consistency that you really want.
Mm-hmm. There you have it. All right, and then as a separate question, what makes a marinade effective? Obvious factors are time, but what about oils, ratios of oils, acids, or other liquids, or the consistency of the herbs and other aromatics? Joshua would like to know. What do you think?
Well, different ingredients are going to provide different things, consistency, for example, you're going to get a lot more direct contact with the meat that you're marinating if the material has been finely comminuted. So if it's ground or very, very finely minced instead of chopped or whole. If it's spices, then some of the aromas are going to get out into the liquid and will get into the meat that way. But there's not much that happens beyond the surface unless you're actually going to leave it in there for days. So that's something to keep in mind.
Or if you vacuum bag.
That's right.
Or jacquard, obviously. If you jacquard it or inject, then you can have this stuff happen very quickly. I mean, I've noticed, okay, so a lot of people, they'll do a buttermilk marinade, which, you know, chicken is fairly friable. Along the fibers, you can get some penetration. And if you vacuum bag it, you especially can, when you cook it that way, I find sometimes it gets, like, acidic brines. For me, if you're not going to take the next step and overcook the meat in a traditional way, if you're going to do sous vide work on it, it just is too mushy to me. You lose too much structure. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I agree. That's something you see. You know, if you do a typical wine marinade and overdo it, then what you end up with is this surface layer that you can just scrape off because the meat has denatured so much, and you don't want that. Using one of the methods that you mentioned in order to speed it up, if you really want some penetration, and otherwise, you know, put the flavors in the sauce.
Right. I mean, when I marinate, you're right, exactly. I put acidic flavors and things like that in the sauce, with rare exceptions, and I put the functional ingredients for the water holding capacity for proteins, salts and sugars and things like that, in the marinade or brine. I mean, that's typically what I do.
Yeah, because salts are going to get into the meat. Flavor molecules are much bigger. Salt breaks down into ions. They're tiny little particles that can move in and out of the meat pretty easily, but flavor molecules are not going to do the same thing.
Right. Caleb has a question about smoking sausage. He purchased some cherry chipotle pork sausage. That's like a cherry chipotle. It's got a ring to it there, right? And he's pretty excited about it. Would simply smoking the sausage as he would for a brisket or pork ribs, would that be a valid and delicious way to cook it? Well, I don't see why not. Do you have any thoughts on that?
No, sounds good to me, and, you know, get some cherry wood.
I mean, the trick with the smoking, right, I mean, the trick with any sort of sausage cookery is that when you're cooking off a sausage, typically what happens is you overcook the hell out of the sausage, and you're relying on the high fat content of the sausage, and hopefully the crafts person who made it, making sure that there's enough fat in there such that it stays juicy even when it's overcooked. Right? So if you can, I would try to control the smoking such that the sausage itself doesn't get much above 140 when you're doing it. And I think then you're going to have like a really, you know, fantastic product. When we're cooking a sausage, is what we'll typically do is water bath them at 140, which is 60 in Celsius land, and then grill them or fry them or pan them to get that nice, you know, kind of crusty outside to it. So I think a lot of it is going to be about the temperature control.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that's one of the most common sins in the kitchen is overcooking sausages and losing all the, you know, all that craftsmanship that goes into mixing the fat with the meat just goes away the moment that you overcook it to the point that all the juices are squeezed out.
Yeah, what's the point, right?
Yeah.
Just because it's a sausage,
it'll taste good, but
right. Yeah, but just because it's a sausage doesn't mean you should mistreat it. You know what I mean? And it's so easy not to mistreat it, especially if you have a circulator on board. You know, you can just it makes life so easy. Anyway, all right. So we're going to go to our first commercial break. If anyone should be around listening, and it's remember we're recording on Monday, not Tuesday. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. 718-497-2128. Cooking issues.
Service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Every Sunday at 4:30 p.m., tune in to Burning Down the House. Architecture is the laser focus of Burning Down the House, a weekly discourse on all things built, destroyed, admired, and despised. Each week, Curtis B. Wayne, your host, invites a posse of authors, critics, builders, designers, and other architecture fiends to reflect on various topics related to perhaps the most functional of all art forms. Again, that's every Sunday at 4:30 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hello, and welcome back to Cooking Issues. Call in your questions to 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Curtis Wayne, host of the show, not to be confused with Wayne Curtis, noted rum scholar. Weird, huh? Harold, you still with us?
Yes, indeed.
Beautiful, beautiful. All right. So, where were we? We had a question. I will read it to you from Colin Gore. He often asks us questions, but this one is specifically for you. Harold, the sweet potato is a delectable amalgam of starch, pectin, sugars, and other components. This I know. This mixed composition of sweet potato guts makes it a very versatile tuber. What I'm fuzzy on is why adding some acid, let's say vinegar, to hot sweet potato puree improves the film-forming properties of the puree upon drying. Without the vinegar, the film is glassy and brittle, but with the vinegar addition, the final film is essentially a kick-ass sweet potato fruit roll-up. I saw a recipe for abulato, which calls for the addition of some vinegar to the simmering potato starch solution, so I assume that the vinegar modifies, interacts with the starch in the sweet potato and other sweet potato components are just along for the ride. What is your hunch on what is being modified? We'll hit that first. By the way, for those of you who don't know, the abulato is that, I think that's how it's pronounced, I don't know. Those are those potato starch sheets that you can wrap things in. You can buy them. I think, I forget where they're made. Are they made in Japan or Spain? I don't know. I don't really use them, but that's what they are. Any thoughts on this, Harold?
You know, this is really interesting. I need to play with this. My guess is that he's right, that it's an effect on the starch. You're getting some limited hydrolysis, and that kind of plasticizes the starch so that when you dry it all the way down, you know, you've got more small sugar molecules and small portions, small pieces of starch that help soften the film so that it can't form as brittle a sheet as he describes. And probably the same thing is going on with the sweet potato. Normally, acidity makes vegetable matter of various kinds harder by limiting the degree to which the cell wall components can be removed. But in this case, it's the opposite effect, and because he's seen it in a pure starch system, my guess is that he's right, that that's what's going on.
Right, but it seems strange that you would have hydrolysis with just a little bit of acid, you know? And conversely, though, it's just not like a protein where you're shifting the isoelectric point by adding a little, by shifting the pH a little bit and then radically changing its properties. It seems odd. Maybe he's adding a lot of acid. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, well, that's it. I don't get an idea here for how much acid is being added. But, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot to change the hydrolysis rate. You'll get hydrolysis of starch in neutral water, just from the water itself. So it might be that just shifting the pH a little bit can make a significant difference.
So it's similar to adding a little bit of acid to a sugar boil when you're boiling it. It's going to increase the breakdown. If the longer you boil it, the higher the breakdown.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And yeah, that's the other thing that's missing here is any sense of timing. You know, how long it takes, whether this happens kind of immediately or whether you have to kind of incubate it to let it happen.
Right.
Because, don't know.
Because any breakdown of the starch into shorter chain, sugars and dextrins and things like that is going to plasticize the sheet somewhat, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Of course,
exactly.
So would adding a maltodextrin, but maybe this is easier, I guess.
Yeah, that's true. If you add small molecules as another ingredient, then you could get the same effect without the acidity and without the flavor of vinegar. And
right.
that might be an interesting alternative.
And vinegar is also an interesting choice because although that's, for instance, what I use in my candy boils and it's traditional, it's a volatile acid. So why, it's interesting that you would choose a volatile acid maybe as a self-limiting measure. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah.
Interesting. Because I'd also have to – I've never done a test of boiling vinegar, testing the pH before and after, and seeing how much of the vinegar, the acidity is reduced by the boiling, once you recorrect for the liquid loss.
Yeah, yeah. I've played around with that a little bit, not really systematically, just kind of, with my left hand while I was doing something else, just out of curiosity. And it seems as though the pH anyway is relatively constant. You know, as you boil it down, boil a 5% solution down, which surprised me.
Because it should get more acidic, right?
You'd think so, but you, as you say, you are boiling off acetic acid as well as water as you boil.
So basically you lost vinegar at almost the same rate as water.
Right, right.
Interesting. I mean, I know for a fact that when you spray dry vinegar, you get the taste of vinegar but not the acidity, so you need to augment the acidity with a separate acid. When you're making, let's say, vinegar potato chips and you're sprinkling vinegar powder, which is spray dried with a maltodextrin carrier, when you do that, you have to add a supplementary acidity to get the acidity back to where you want it. So, I mean, it's volatile enough. And then, Colin's second question, because we have pumped your awesome walnuts on the show, so he has a question here. Is there anywhere on the East Coast that a fellow can find walnuts low in tannins and astringency? Is it merely a matter of harvesting walnuts in an immature state on San Giovanni's Day, as many Nocino recipes call for? I did not know that. I don't know what species grow in Italy where those recipes originate, and we have black walnuts locally. I'm interested in finding nearby sweet nuts, as yours are likely off limits. I would be delighted if you could enlighten us further on the matter. All right, let's have the talk on walnuts.
I don't think there's anything off limits about California walnuts. I think they'd love to sell more of them. The problem is finding a source on the East Coast of the good stuff, because, you know, that it ranges from good to not so good. And you can tell just by looking at the nuts how astringent they're going to be. The lighter the seed coat, the milder they're going to be. And of course, you want to make sure by looking at them as well that they're fresh, because that's going to be the other problem. You know, if they've been shipped across the country, then who knows what kind of shape they're in once they get there. Immature walnuts are wonderful, but they're nothing like the walnuts we're talking about here. They're wonderful, crunchy. They're not that astringent, but boy, you have to wear gloves in order to deal with them, right?
Stain the heck out of your hands, right?
Yeah. They do have that. The fruits do give you that wonderful kind of aroma that's nothing like a standard, you know, dried walnut aroma. But yeah, it's a completely different experience and a mess.
Right. Well, as a kid, I used to play around with that stuff. That stuff does not come out of your hands. It just doesn't.
Right.
Because we had a bunch of walnut trees around. But the so at your house, we tried the red walnuts, which people are pushing, but those weren't the miracle nuts. They were nice. They were good, the red walnuts. Maybe you could say something about those. But it was these very low astringency. Why don't they just ship only that? Like, is it more difficult to produce? Is it a tree-by-tree variation the same way it is with acorns? You know, some acorns are more bitter than others. And you just have to know the tree. I mean, I don't really know much about walnut propagation. Is walnut clonal? Is it done by graft? Is it done by seed? Is it just lucky shots? Like, why isn't every – and as a separate ancillary question, like, why are California almonds so low in oil? Why? Why do they grow them so low in oil? But in other words, like, could they make all the walnuts this delicious and they just don't?
I think so. I think it's, for the most part, a matter of variety. And you know, there's a particular guy I go to at the farmer's market out here who has several different batches. He's got red walnuts, he's got the really light-skinned walnuts, and he's got darker ones. And they're priced accordingly. The red ones are more expensive than the light ones, which are more expensive than the dark ones. And, you know, you can take your pick.
We like the light ones best, though, right?
Yeah, because they have the just the nicest flavor, the nicest nutty flavor. I think the reason, though, the red ones are awfully good. The red ones have, instead of having tannins in the brown seed coat, they have anthocyanins, the same pigments that give color to lots of fruits and vegetables, grapes, things like that. They're very delicious too, and they're not nearly as tannic as standard walnuts. I think the reason you didn't like them as much is that batch of red ones wasn't as fresh as my batch of pale ones.
Ah, so they're just as walnutty.
Yeah. No, they're delicious.
All right. Well, yeah. I stand corrected then on the red nuts. But what's this farmer's name? Do you know?
I don't. I know it's on his truck, and I'm just not able to pull it into memory at the moment.
He's at the ferry market, the ferry terminal market?
No, he's actually at the Alemany Farmers Market.
All right, well, go look for the sweet nuts at Alemany Farmers Market.
Right.
But why can't they – you think it's just freshness? It can't be. Like, why do they even grow the darker skin? Is it just easier?
Yeah, I think it's and it may be that it's just a matter of you know, farmers covering their bets. If they just all grow the same variety and there happens to be a problem with that variety, it's the old you know, monoculture problem. And also, I'm just not exactly sure which variety is which here. It may be that this is a new one or it's an old one and it's not as productive. There might be all kinds of reasons for the predominance of the darker, more tannic nuts.
Right. I mean, I really don't know much about walnut culture at all. I don't know how long it takes for a tree to come into bearing, or, I mean, I know they bear for a long time, but I don't know kind of what the farm cycle is on a walnut tree. Why are almonds from California so low in oil? Do they do that on purpose?
It's a good question. You and I have tried to figure that one out. Why are almonds from California just not more delicious?
Yeah. And no offense, California.
They could. I mean, talk about tannic, tough, thick skins. There's no mistaking a California almond. And I don't know, it may be a matter of agronomic yield rather than quality. I'll look into that. Yeah. I'll ask some questions.
Because I would pay more for more. In fact, we do. We pay more for European almonds that are higher in oil and more delicious.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Mm. Anyway. All right. Aaron writes in from Hull, and he says that he's going to be curing some bacon next week, and he intends to use Michael Ruhlman's charcuterie recipe for it, which is 450 grams of salt to 225 grams of sugar to 50 grams pink salt. Pink salt, I'm assuming he's using the Instacure number one, which is nitrite, not a nitrate. You want to make sure that you know which pink salt you're dealing with. And he's going to coat the pork belly with some of this mixture and leave it in the fridge or freezer for some number of days before roasting it until it reaches an internal temperature of 65, et cetera, et cetera. Kosher salt is hard to come by where I live. Is sea salt like Malden I think he means Malden. It says Morden here, but Malden's a suitable substitute. Suitable, but extremely expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, the main thing you're going to want to do is I mean, I don't really think it makes that much of a difference in that people have all these questions about whether or not certain salts are bad for curing. It's true that sea salts probably have some sort of extra minerals in them, but I don't know what they add to the brining process. In pickles, it's extremely important not to use certain salts because they can discolor the pickle, but I don't know that it's a big deal in a brine for a bacon. Do you, Harold?
I don't think so. I know that it is an issue in the curing of fish, white fish like cod, because the calcium and magnesium salts can end up causing the cod to yellow. But with a bacon, that's not an issue.
Right. And ham guys swear that the type of salt that they use makes a difference. In fact, I'm wearing a Finchfield Farms country ham hat right now. they say it makes a difference, but I don't really know what the basis is. I could go research. I have Fidel Toldra's book on dry cured meat products, and I could look into the effect of the different salt components. But I am sure that you will be fine. If your wallet allows you to use Malden, then go ahead. Oh, maybe they meant Morton sea salt. Any sea salt's going to work fine. I would like to try a bacon cure with maple syrup for a friend. Should I just add some maple syrup to the freezer bag? I'm planning on doing this by eye until it's pretty evenly covered. Does this affect the curing process in any way that I should know? Well, you're going to be doing a wet cure in that, and you would substitute maple syrup for the water and sugar and then put salt into the maple syrup, I assume. Right, Harold?
That sounds right to me, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Number three was, how long should I leave the bacon to cure? I'm guessing the amount of time will be a function of the size, shape, weight of the meat I am curing. Could you give me some guidelines? I don't have any in my head. I believe that the charcuterie book, Michael Ruhlman's book, has some guidelines in it. You can accelerate the cure by putting it in a vacuum bag, but usually penetration is based on the actual strength of the brine you're using, which is crucial. So if you're going to add water to it, like with maple syrup, that's going to reduce the brine, theoretical brine strength. And then on a certain number of days for penetration, a certain number of inches into the meat, and it also is going to depend on the particular fat, the fat quantity in your piece of meat versus the lean. Do you have anything on that, Harold?
No, that's about all I could come up with. There are charts in books and as you say, days per inch guidelines, that's really the place to go.
Yeah. And then lastly, he's just ordered a piece of equipment that will allow him to try sous vide cooking at home. Congratulations. Would he be better cooking the pork belly this way after curing or not? If so, is there anything he should look out for using this method? Okay, I happen to love pork belly cooked sous vide, in which case you choose the temperature you want to cook. In general, I would do something below 65, something like 63, 62, 63, even as low as 60. It's going to take – that's Celsius, so 140 and up in that range – it's going to take a long time, like two, three days to get tender to where you want, and then crisp up the skin. And I think he asked later, should he leave the rind on? I would. Wouldn't you?
Yes, definitely.
I would leave the rind on, and then I wouldn't trim it at all. I would crisp the skin up and serve it, because that's the best part once it's crisp. I mean, leave it on forever is what I would do.
Yeah. Gnaw it off.
Yeah, it's going to sound a little gross. But you might want to trim away the areas where the teats are, just because they don't they don't fit the pan as well. The crucial thing when cooking a pork belly for later cooking is to compress it a little bit before you do, so that you get a nice flat surface to pan the skin on to make it nice and crunchy. The other thing I've noticed, and Harold, I think we've talked about this before, is that when you have the pork belly isn't one specific muscle. It's a group of muscles.
Yeah.
And some of them, the ones that are the streaky portion, and a streaky bacon, let's say, they respond very well to cooking for a long time, on the order of several days. There's one muscle that runs through the pork belly that you can really see in the cut, that's called in Chinese five fingers or five flower, whatever it is, pork. One of those muscles doesn't respond very well to long cooking and gets mushy and kind of tastes kind of dry. And so it's a muscle that looks a little oval as you cut through the pork belly. I would take it out, and cook that some other way. Have you had that experience with pork belly? Or have you noticed
yeah.
that?
Yeah. I mean, no matter who's made it, if that muscle is in there, then it's just different from the others. Kind of like the shoulder. There's so many different muscles that some of them are just wonderful and others are less so.
Right. I would say different and worse.
Yeah.
All right, and with that, listen, if anyone's out there, you have one more chance to call in. 718, we're going to go to our second commercial break. Call in 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128, Cooking Issues. Welcome back to Cooking Issues, 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. Our producer, Jack, was pumping up the Hall & Oates, this particular song, because he thinks it's nice rainy day weather, which it is here in Brooklyn, rainy. I'll say one last time, you have a couple more days to go to mofad.eventbrite.com to purchase tickets for the museum fundraiser. I'll tell you a little bit about what I'm doing at the end of the show. But right now, let's get back. We have Harold McGee on the phone. Hey, would you consider the next time you're in town on a Tuesday to do the show live here at the studio?
I'd love to. Love to.
Nice. I saw our mutual buddy Nathan Myhrvold this morning. Nathan's doing his book tour. He booked out Jean George's restaurant in the morning, and they cook some of the dishes from his cookbook. And he might be a phone-in guest at some point, which would be fun. Just pushing, we have some good guests, coming. Like apparently, Grant Achatz is gonna be on the show sometime in May, I think. I guess to push the opening of the new place or what? I don't know. I heard from his publicist. Anyways, this is what's going on in Cooking Issues Land. All right, now we have a question for you from Tom M. My question for Mr. McGee is, does extended brining denature the enzymes in beef responsible for tenderizing it? I wish to have a tender corned beef brisket and have considered cooking it sous vide for 131 for 12 to 24 hours, shocking it in an ice bath, and only then brining it. But if brining does not denature the tenderizing enzymes, then I might as well brine it for a couple of days, then do 131 sous vide, followed by low temperature smoking, and only then do a high temperature sous vide to get the collagen transforming temperatures for the appropriate length of time. Am I making things too complicated? And can I achieve it in a simpler manner? Well, I'll say two things before I hand it off to you, Harold.
Right.
One, you don't want to shock. You never want to shock a protein like that after it comes out of the bath, because if you do, you're basically going to prevent the meat from reabsorbing some of the juices that have been expelled during the cooking. And even at 131, you're going to get juices expelled. So you're not going to want to do that. I'm also going to say that I think that 131's a little low for brisket. You might want to it's people do it all the time. Very rare long cookings like this. But I find that people, if they're expecting a cut of meat that is meant to be a little higher in temperature, it's better to go a little higher in temperature. But with that, let me hand it off to you, Harold.
I'd be interested to see what that's like, 131 brisket, but I have a feeling I'd prefer it at a higher temperature. And then on the issue of brining denaturing the enzymes, I've actually never thought of that. I know in pretty good detail what's happening to the fiber proteins during brining. And that's the major effect of tenderizing effect of a brine on meat, is that it kind of unknits the muscle fibers and makes them easier to cut through. I've never thought about whether the salt conditions are going to change the activity of the enzymes that do to some extent break down the collagen and the fiber proteins. And so that's something I'm going to go look up when we're all done. I have no idea.
Right.
But as a general principle, you want to do the brining before the cooking, not after. The brining is only going to have its tenderizing, moistening effects if you do it while the meat is raw.
Right, and also you can't cure cooked meat, right? I mean, corned beef is cured somewhat, so it's not going to be... You can't cure cooked meat, can you?
It's kind of an interesting counterintuitive sort of thing. I think probably, yeah, what's going to happen is that you will desiccate it. But the meat is cooked. It's done. And anything you do to it with salt afterwards is just going to dry it out and make it salty.
Right. Yeah, it's interesting. I've never even thought about trying to brine something afterward. But, I mean, corned beef, typically, you'd add some amount of nitrite to it, wouldn't you? I mean, it's pink usually, right? So it's been pinked. It definitely won't pink out. You're going to have it look gray. Well, you want it these temperatures at 131. I can't do the math in my head, but that's somewhere in the mid-50s, right? 131,
yeah.
Somewhere in the mid-50s Celsius. And, you know, we do our short ribs a lot in that range, but find that people prefer them up closer to 140, between, you know, 140 and a little over. But I definitely don't think you need to go through like a million different steps. I think it's going to probably affect it. You know, like the more steps, the more chance for things to going wrong, things to dry out, things to problems. What do you think?
No, I agree. And if there's a straightforward way to do it, it's almost always the best way to do it.
Yeah. All right. So in the those are the questions that have come in. So good. We have at least 4 or 5 minutes. We can. What are you working on?
I've actually been taking a little bit of a hiatus for a variety of reasons, and have not cooked anything serious in like a month.
Wow.
So, but spring is coming, and I'm sure that's going to change fast. One thing I'm going to do this coming weekend that I'm looking forward to is head off to Spain for a last meal at El Bulli.
Because it's for real going to be the last, it's like real deal last now?
Apparently July 30th, I think, is the date now. The restaurant will close as a restaurant and then reopen in the next day or two as a think tank.
Right. So who are you going with?
A chef out here in California named Daniel Patterson.
I love Daniel Patterson.
Yeah.
Yeah, his restaurant's great.
Yeah.
And, you know, we worked together, we all did on Mandy Aftel's and his taste. What was it called? Taste the smell. What was it called? Smell the glove? What was it?
Alchemy was in there somewhere.
Yeah, alchemy of taste and smell.
Yeah.
You have any articles in the pipeline that you want to let out of the bag, or you want to keep them in the bag?
No, in fact, that's something else I've been taking a hiatus from. But I'm hoping to get another Curious Cook column into the New York Times in about a month.
Yeah, if people crave it, but you don't know what you're going to do yet.
Actually, it's going to be about salt.
Oh, yeah? What about
it?
And like what kind of aspects? So many aspects to salt.
Well, exactly that. The fact that there are now so many salts, and some people say that they all taste different, and that, for example, kosher salt is horrible stuff. Nobody should ever touch it. So I've collected probably close to 20 at this point, and there's been a very interesting controlled study with a professionally trained taste panel that actually tasted about 20 different salts to see if they could tell the difference.
In what form?
As a 0.8% solution.
Mm.
To try to maximize the opportunity to taste the difference, because, of course, if you're going to take salt and put it in mashed potatoes or something, odds are you're going to have no clue.
Right. And so this is an extension of a project. Was it part of the Ariche things that Steingarten went to? Because he was doing it in Ariche years and years ago in his first book on salt. Remember that?
That's right. In fact, I remember that tasting very well. He arrived with these little vials of some of his favorite salts and some of his least favorites, and then there was a sensory scientist who took part in the Ariche meetings every year, and so he organized a triangle test where basically you're handed three little vials and you have to tell which one is different from the other two, and we all took the test in a series of groups, and then they tabulated the results at the end, and it turned out that of the 40 people in attendance, only one person was able to correctly distinguish all of the different salts.
And was that a fluke, or reliably, repeatedly was able to do it?
We only did it once, so it may have been a fluke, but because that one person was Jeffrey Steingarten,
oh,
of course it wasn't.
That's hilarious. All right, so we'll be looking forward to that, and I'll just say what I'm working on for the museum fundraiser coming up. I'm doing the amuse-bouche. We like to, you know, in the back room, we always call it the amuse-douche because I think it's a ridiculous word, amuse-bouche. So the amuse-douche will be I gave myself food as medicine as my theme, because, you know, everyone has a theme. Like Chang is doing a pre-1491 food in America. So he's doing oysters and acorns. Wiley's got caveman food, Mark Ladner Rome, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So I gave myself food as medicine, and I'm using an ingredient. I'm using okay. So it turns out that bitumen, you know, like pitch. Piss asphalt,
yeah.
Uh-huh. It's exuded in the Dead Sea area and in Iran, and has been used as a medicine for centuries. As has a very similar exudate from the Himalayas called Shilajit, right? And so, which is used in Ayurvedic medicine a lot. The Shilajit is, and so. This was mistranslated by from the Arab, because Arab medicine was the medicine in the 800-900s, in that range, right? So this was mistranslated by medieval scholars in like the 11th century as because the word in Arabic is mumiyai, like sounds like mummy, and in fact the word English word for mummy is derived from the same root of like this waxy pitch bitumen. Our word comes from it. Anyway, mistranslated this medicinal ingredient mummy as ground up human cadavers from Egyptian mummies, and here started the trade in medicinal mummies. So mummies were ground up by the boatload and sold in apothecaries all over Europe. And in fact, they ran out of a reliable mummy supply, so they would make counterfeit mummies by grinding up and you know, taking fresh cadavers, drying them out, and grinding them up. And so the original pitch, right, which was the part that the bitumen, which wasn't actually in an authentic mummy because they didn't use bitumen until very late in the mummification process because it was cheap. You know, they used much more expensive stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
But so it changed from the bitumen being the important part of the medicine to the actual corpse. So then it got transmogrified even more, so that later on it was found that if someone died very suddenly in the prime of life, then that's the best mummy that you can get. So like for centuries up until the prime time was like 16th and 17th century was prime mummy medicine time. But it extended for a long time, plus mummy was used as a pigment up until the early 20th century. The mummy was a specific color of brown made by grinding up mummies. But it's come full circle again, and also spawned like vampire legends, all sorts of cool, weird stuff, which I think I'm going to write about for the blog, definitely, maybe for somewhere else. And I've located a source of the Shilajit, which is the one from the Himalayas. It's used in Ayurvedic medicine. And so I'm going to have that as mummy. I'm going to put that onto rhubarb that I'm going to cook sous vide, because Francis the First of France always carried with him mummy and rhubarb as some of his medicaments to help him from whatever ailed him. So that's going to be one component is mummy and rhubarb. And the next component is going to be when he was defeated by Charles V. He was held captive, and the zuppa alla pavese was invented for him at that capture, which is basically bread with an egg that's cooked by broth that's put in with shavings of Parmesan. So I'm going to do a little toast with a gilet of broth, low temperature done quail egg and Parmesan tuile. And so the other two components you will have to come to the fundraiser to taste to know that. Anyway, so I'm going to thank Harold for being on the show. Hopefully we'll get you in live next time you're in. Hopefully we'll talk to you soon. And we'll leave you with mummies cooking issues.
Vicious, vicious vodka. Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
And I just can't get it straight.
The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Bolte of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of BR Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.